Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Paul Segreto at the Franchise Today Show with my ever-loving co-host from Cleveland, Ohio, at the foot of Lake Erie, Joe LaBava, the Franchise King.
Hey, how you doing up there, down there, all around? Welcome to the Franchise Today Show. What's going on there, Paul?
Not much. Joel, I understand you were quite the celebrity this past Friday on past Monday on Fox Business News. Tell us a little bit about it. I know some of our listeners have seen the video, and I've seen it as well. It was quite good, but tell us a little bit about the experience.
Oh, thanks. It actually wasn't on the Fox Business TV channel. That'll be next, hopefully. It was on one of their web-only things, and what they do is they have a remote studio in the town where or the city where they're interviewing someone. I went to a recording studio and did it live. And, you know, it's pretty cool. I mean, I've been on, you know, done some news shows before, so I know what it's like. But this was weird because I was, like, talking to, shall we say, nobody. I was just looking at a camera and some big old Klieg lights making my forehead spitz. So I brought makeup with me because I know my forehead gets a little shiny. And I had a blast. I mean, it was really cool. Knowledgeable hosts of the program. And, you know, it's been very, very well received. We just put it on Small Business Trends, and Anita was kind enough to say, yeah, Joel, put it up there. What the heck? Because I was able to go through like five different topics in 6 minutes. So it was fun. So everyone, thanks for your support. Thanks for watching. You know, and a lot of requests to do something with that crown. So we'll see. But, yeah, it was cool. Thank you. Thanks for asking.
So which crown
you?
Which crown are you going to stick with?
I'll tell you, man. I paid $100 out for a contest. And this guy, this local guy in Cleveland, Jim Evans, found me this gold one, and it was really kind of cool looking. It definitely fits better. I might actually be able to wear it for like 3 seconds without getting laughed at. But the reporter who did the original story about franchising that I was in grabbed a photo of the old one with the red velvet thing. So I don't know, man. It might have to be the red velvet thing. I just have to keep it smushed down because I look like a freaking cardinal. And not the bird. I mean, the thing is, like, so tall. So, so that's the information update on the crown. Thank you for asking.
Well, I really like the velvet crown.
Yeah, well, you would.
I think we need to, like, a big velvet, red velvet cape and get you one of those staff to hold at your side, and we can dress up Winston as the royal.
Yeah, a royal family, all right.
Well, yeah. We don't have a lot of time to BS around today. What's
right.
going on in
That's
the
right.
blog world today?
Well, over at our usual place, alltap.com, there's actually a couple stories. Pretty cool, starting out with Franchise Direct, which is really based in Ireland. I didn't do that invitation to that. Ireland, not that. That's about as far as I can go. They're talking about McDonald's. Now, I don't know about you, Paul, but to this day, McDonald's, to me anyway, is the Rolls Royce of franchising. Without a doubt, everything they have in place is just about perfect. Their French fryer is patented. They usually own the property. They're very selective about their franchise owners. It's just from top to bottom, I think it's the best of the best. Having said that, when they speak, I listen. And I think that the franchise industry and obviously Wall Street listens. And they're pretty darn bullish on the future. I think that they're feeling that their dollar menu and all the stuff they're doing is really driving revenue. Their stock price has been doing good. The bottom of the article is clearly the challenge for McDonald's and indeed everyone in the quick serve sector is balancing the surge in consumer frugality brought on by the recession with a constant demand for a high quality product. So, I go to McDonald's. I love it. It's definitely my favorite fast food place. I'm not like a Big Mac guy. I like a plain hamburger, man. No cheese, just a plain hamburger. And they have this double hamburger for like $1. And what you do, I mean, it's kind of weird, but you have to order it as a double cheeseburger without the cheese. Doesn't matter. Anyway, it's $1. And I'll tell you, The places are just always busy. And the nice thing about McDonald's is you can go to McDonald's in Houston, Texas, or Cleveland, Ohio. It's pretty much going to look, feel, and smell the same. What do you think, Paul?
I agree, and I definitely agree that McDonald's is the leader. It's the model that everybody follows. I mean, it amazes me how they can take over segments of the industry. When they came out with breakfasts, there were so many different restaurants, obviously, that serve breakfast, but McDonald's jumps into the foray of breakfast, and next thing you know, they serve more breakfast than any other entity in the world, with the exception of the armed services.
Yeah.
And then they venture into coffee, and the next thing you know, everybody's taking notice, and everybody's trying to adapt and almost try to catch up or hold on to their footing. And, of course, I'm talking about Starbucks. And it just amazes me that, you know, McDonald's is able to do so with a couple of quick, broad strokes, and they make it happen. Yet, here they are, you know, notwithstanding their experience in Iceland, which, of course, they recently closed their locations, but, I mean, they epitomize fast food franchises, and especially hamburger franchises. And yet, they still don't have onion rings, nor a hot dog on their menu. And I find that very interesting, and I think it just gives you an idea that they just don't run out there and add anything without really trying it completely. When you look at the menu at a Jack in the Box, they've got everything under the sun, from egg rolls to hamburgers to breakfast items to chicken nuggets and everything. When you go to even Burger King, had some various, you know, chicken parmesan sandwiches and stuff like that. You look at the likes of Subway, and now they're trying to copy Quiznos with, you know, grilled sandwiches. And so it's like nobody has their own defined arena with the exception of McDonald's. They refuse to really go so wide that it hurts them. Instead, they drill down. They find something that sticks, and then they do it better than anybody else.
I'm glad that we're in agreement about this. As I knew we would be. They're just the best of the best, I think, in at least in the food segment. And I want to say, out of all the franchisors in the world, I cannot believe, like, for instance, on the Entrepreneur Magazine 500. That they do every year. I can't believe that it's not number one every year. I mean, it's usually in the top three, but still amazes me that they're not number one consistently. Anyway, that's good stuff. Another interesting. Speaking of food, let me interrupt you a second.
Yeah. Because mentioned the double meat hamburger at Burger King.
Yeah,
I know you
yeah.
mentioned this in the. Radio on the interview the other day with Fox Business News Online about the franchisee suing Burger King over the dollar cheese, double meat cheeseburger, claiming that it cost them $1.10 to make that product. Now, and I'm correct, right? That's what I heard.
Yes.
But, you know, I really don't think, the long and the short of it, and I understand all the FTC rulings of, you know, price fixing, and I know all these commercials that say at participating locations, and I think the Burger King franchisees, because I know they've turned down or they reneged and squashed any efforts of doing this dollar double cheeseburger several times before, and I think that the feeling is that they were forced into this, although they probably weren't physically forced into it. I'm sure there was other underlying incentives that make them feel that they're forced into it. But I think the long and the short of it really isn't so much that they've been forced into it as there seems to be some type of communication that's breaking down between corporate and franchisees, and this is just something they're throwing out there as a as almost the last straw. And I think that just kind of says something about how important communication is in a franchise organization, and both parties to the franchise organization truly feeling and truly having an interdependent relationship. Because to me, like you said, there's plenty of places that use lost leaders. And a dime on an item when they're going to have high-profit fries and high-profit drinks and stuff that usually go along with it, I don't think it's as much that dime on the product as it is the way it's being shoved down their throats, the way the communication has broken down. I mean, do you feel along the same lines?
Yeah, I'm okay with price leaders, first of all. Grocery stores do it with, when they have a 24-pack of Pepsi for $3.99. Guess what, folks? It's a loser. it's a loser. So they know you're going to go into the store and buy a bag of potato chips for $3.99, which is a home run for them. So, I mean, there is a deeper story to this, though, because Burger King franchisees, I don't think in general as a group, have been happy for a long time. And I understand that there was a buyout. Some venture capital firm, I think, bought them out, made some money, and now someone else has it. So it hasn't been a happy bunch. But you know what? If you're in business, it's a lot better with bodies in the store than empty. So get the people in the store. I mean, Paul, if you and I would meet up one day in Houston or Cleveland or Boston, and you and I would say, let's go to McDonald's, let's do some lunch, or let's go to Burger King and do some lunch, whatever. If we go in and buy a double cheeseburger for $1, are we just going to have a double cheeseburger? Hello? I mean, I think it's short-sighted by the franchisees, and I'm usually very, very pro-franchisee, but in this case, I'm not. I think that they just need I don't know. I don't think a lawsuit was necessary, but I don't have $700,000 tied up in a Burger King.
Yeah, and I think, too, you bring up a good point that it's not going to be the only thing that we're going to eat. And you think of families or groups of people going in, and one person or two people might get that dollar double meat cheeseburger, and everybody else might be getting, McDeluxe and all these high-dollar items. I mean,
Right.
That's one of those new deluxe meals. I mean, it's like $6-$7. They're making some money on it. So I agree, and I just, hate to see continued litigation over things like that. And like I said, I think it just had to do with, more communications than anything. So, hey, guys, get off the front pages and stop making franchising look like we're a very litigation-oriented business model, and let's make it happen. You also mentioned on the franchise blog about McDonald's. They put in there yesterday, and I just noticed it today, facts from the Canadian franchise market, and unbeknownst to me, they quoted one of my recent blogs, and I was really happy about that. I mean, our neighbors to the north have been just banging down my door for assistance, and it seems like, somebody threw a switch up there over the last month or two. And, and here's something. I know we're going off base a little bit of what we discussed in our pre-show meeting today, but unlike a lot of franchisors that I talk to here in the States that are all saying, we're really hurting because we haven't been able to sell franchises, and I need to figure out a way to sell franchises. And can you help me with social media in order to sell franchises? And can you recommend the right portals and brokers to sell franchises? And everything is sell franchises, sell franchises, sell franchises. And yet, I've talked with about 13 to 14 different franchisors in the last month or so up in Canada that have contacted me, and all of them, almost all of them, completely across the board, start out with, we want to bolster our operations, we want to improve our support, we want to revamp our training, and it's all because we want to be prepared for when the next wave of franchise sales occurs. We would like to sell more franchises now, but we feel we want to put a lot of effort and resources into fortifying our organization and so that we get to the position when we are ready to sell franchises again, and that next wave of candidates comes in the door, that our current franchisees will be sure to validate. Plus, that our franchisees need this support and extra training right now, maybe even just to survive. And that, to me, tells me that they get it, and they're willing to firm up the foundation before they put more building blocks on top. Now, when I discussed this with a very notable franchise executive, Joseph Caruso, yesterday, he brought up a good point that it's like the franchisors there are acting the same way the U.S. franchisors did 15 or 20 years ago in the States. So I'm almost, I agree with him on that, and I almost think our franchisors here need to take a couple of steps back and work more on building up communication, sharing information, strengthening their franchise base, that as the market turns and as credit gets freed up, as we spoke about last week, as all that occurs, they'll be in a stronger position to sell franchises because the system will have been fortified and the franchisees will be validating your concept. And I think this is real important, that franchise organizations take this approach.
I think you're right. Canadian franchise, I don't know. I've worked with some Canadian franchisors when I was with a brokerage group a few years ago. Definitely a different breed, but I can tell you a very, very successful one that came out of Canada, 1-800-GOT-JUNK. I mean, they rocked, man. I mean, they did a lot of stuff right, and there's a lot of franchisees that are you know, picking up junk. So, watch your junk.
Absolutely. Well, we're obviously going to get back to this. I know you have another blog article to talk about. Which one was that?
Yeah, you know, I do. But you know what I was thinking before, Paul? I haven't been as sarcastic the past few shows as I probably need to be. And they also, I don't think I've offended anybody for a while. Have I?
No, I don't think you have.
Because I was thinking about the Burger King thing and the McDonald's thing. And we did forget one issue when it comes to, you know, eating at Burger King or eating at McDonald's. You know, the big difference is in the burgers, right?
Well, one is flame broiled and one is grilled.
But you said it wrong. One is flame broiled, Paul. Anyway, not that I've offended some people. I apologize, and I'm going to go to the next item. Speaking of fruit, Froyo franchises, is frozen yogurt a fad? A gentleman from all the way across the globe, Ivan Wijaya, and I'm probably butchering his name. Anyway, his franchise blog, Franchise Notes, is actually looking pretty good. And he's talking about a new, I think it's a new one, called Froyo, frozen yogurt. When my little father was in the franchising business, he was involved with TCBY early on. And I remember he was pretty excited about it for a couple of years. But, I mean, after that, it got pretty ugly. Is it a fad? I don't know. You can talk to Thinkberry. They seem to be doing pretty good. I don't go out of my way personally to go to a frozen yogurt place. I don't. I have a feeling you don't either. You know, food is weird, especially frozen food, frozen treats. You know, you have Rita's and Dairy Queen and It's a really funky market, and you know, as you and I both know, because we're in the industry as opposed to people that are, you know, trying to look at franchises and maybe buy the thing that's hot, a couple ice cream franchises in the past few years have, it's been ugly, and you know which ones I'm talking about. So what do you think about the frozen yogurt thing? Is it a fad? Is it a craze? Is it just eh?
Well, I think it is coming back. Not to say that it's not a fad again, because I've even noticed TCBY is opening up again here in Houston.
I know.
Yeah, I know they're part of the group with Great American Cookie and Pretzel Time and Pretzel Maker. And I think it's a good additional franchise for their franchisees.
Yeah.
But I think where the success in the frozen treats segment of franchising, if you'll call it that, is through co-branding. You know, Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin-Robbins are under the same flag now, and it's a great co-branding effort because it brings in people at different times of the day and at different times of the year. So a franchisee has more of a chance of success by having two products. Carvel, which is an ice cream chain out of the Northeast, difficult time with standalone Carvels, and now under their flag, they're also co-branding with Cinnabon. And I see the same thing happening with Great American Cookie and TCBY. And with some of these other chains, like you described, and if you look at some of the gelato chains that are out there, I don't know if they're going to make it in mainstream America.
Right.
I think if they're in an area that's got tremendous foot traffic, you know, a big thing in retailing are now these open-air market town centers. You know, fine, but how many of them can a city, you know, support? I know here in Houston, you know, there are maybe three or four of those type open-air markets, and Houston is too big for just four franchisees of that type of chain. I mean, they need, you know, 30 or 40 to have critical mass, to build brand awareness, to have cooperative advertising, to have buying power, to have a presence. So that's where I see the problem occurring. And then when you look at the cost to open up one of these things, I know you take Cold Stone Creamery. I mean, you're talking $300,000 to open up something that I just don't see how the numbers work by itself.
I know. And you know what? I have to apologize. You know, I'm an idiot. The title of the post is Froyo Franchises is Frozen Yogurt a Fad. I'm an idiot. Froyo is not the franchise. That's kind of a nickname for frozen yogurt. So I apologize. We know that Pinkberry is a franchise, and there's some others, but I have to apologize. I'm an idiot. I'm just not going to talk for about 3 minutes.
You know, there's one in the gelato segment, which of course is an Italian type dessert, frozen dessert. And there's a company out of Dallas called Paciugo, P-A-C-I-U-G-O. And they have a fabulous gelato product. But, you know, and I've seen them where they're real busy in these open market type town centers that we discussed. But if they're just going to open up in a strip shopping center and think that the masses are going to just flock in there, the old build it and they will come routine, I don't see it happening. I think those places are better in a congregation area, in a co-branding area that other people coming in. I mean, you know, quite frankly, Dairy Queen, you know, has really built up their food side of the business. And then people have, you know, dessert as a treat afterwards. Which is good, but these others that are standalone, I just don't know. Unless they really think outside the box and try to franchise within a franchise or within a business, like at a movie theater or something like that. Other than that, I'm not a fan. And then, of course, you're butting heads with the likes of McDonald's that sells a tremendous amount of frozen desserts. And
yeah,
I would have to think, you know, if McDonald's goes as they have true to form historically, you know, are they going to be targeting the frozen dessert market as their next coffee or breakfast segment? I don't know if I want to be in that business and go head-to-head with the likes of McDonald's, and coffee is a prime example. You know, mention it to McCafe's. They spent the money to put them up within the McDonald's. And, yeah, they're battling with Starbucks.
Not really.
But the Gloria Jeans, the It's a Grind.
Yeah.
Coffee Beanery, and all those are closing around them. And it's going to be McDonald's and Starbucks. So before you go venturing into frozen desserts, I would start looking at that type of trend that may occur.
Yeah. McDonald's is just, I mean, you know, okay, so the machines were $25,000 and it was hard to get financed for a little while, you know, a year and a half ago. But I you know, when I go to McDonald's, which is maybe once every week, week and a half, you know, I'm always hanging around the coffee area waiting for something to get finished. And I ask them how they're doing, and they're just like, man, we're rocking. We are selling so much coffee, it's ridiculous.
Well, I understand, too, that they're testing out some standalone McCafés that will be coffee-driven, dessert-type driven, as well as a limited sandwich menu to go along with it. You know, I mean, when somebody like McDonald's steps up to the plate in that, everybody else better get their head out of the sand and watch and listen and see how it works.
Yeah. Put it like this, I wouldn't want to be any type of business going against McDonald's for any type of product. They're too good. They're too good. Rarely do they blow it.
They're really good. Anyway, you know, today's franchise candidates, as we've often said, you know, are more educated, more sophisticated, more technologically advanced, they're more cautious, they're more anxious, they're more diligent than ever before. And I think it's really important that they look into, as they look into different franchise segments, that they really do their research very diligently in order to not only look at the rah-rah coming out of the franchise organization, but, you know, look at the industry segment just like we're discussing here today. You know, and one of the things, too, Joel, I knew you have a book that I would like to talk about here on the show that would help a lot of franchise candidates. And I know you have it on your website and on your blog site. And tell us a little bit about the book and how it helps franchise candidates and what specifically they should look for.
Sure. I wrote this book, I'm going to say almost 2 years ago now. I think it's 50 pages. It's an ebook. It's called The Essential Steps to Researching a Franchise Opportunity. There's a guy out there that copied almost word for word the title, which is, you know, I guess it's part of the, you know, the open social media internet stuff. Anyway, what it does is it takes a franchise candidate through the process a step at a time. And I think the best part about the book is after working with so many franchise candidates, I developed a 2-page list of questions that need to be asked to the franchise executives, to the franchisees, that most people don't ask. And I'll tell you what's amazing, Paul. I still do a number of seminars on franchise ownership. It amazes me how many people talk to me afterwards that might own a Subway franchise or something, or a cousin owns one that they know, and they said, boy, I wish I would have known about what questions I should ask. I mean, Paul, you've been doing this long enough to know that there are people that have actually purchased franchises, $150,000 investments, that never talked to one franchisee. It wasn't even on their radar because they were so hopped up and so full of emotion that they forgot to do that little tiny, bitsy, microscopic important thing called getting the facts. So that's what the book does. It just shows franchise candidates how to get the facts step by step all the way through the end, how to find a franchise attorney, what kind of CPA to look for, information for business plans. But it's real easy to follow, real simple. There's a full review over at smallbusinesstrends.com. If you just look under franchise books, under the search, I think you'll see a review. And it's just a simple, easy to follow book. Website for it, I have a special website set up, www.franchiseresearchsteps.com. FranchiseResearchSteps.com. The ebook available at a store near you.
Well, that's great. I highly recommend everybody check that out. You know, it amazes me when we talk about industry segments. I was watching a show on the Travel Channel the night before last, and it was the Pizza Wars, and they were pitting New York pizza versus Chicago pizza. And
Chicago.
That's a whole different discussion for a different day. But they said...
Wait a second. Aren't you from Chicago?
No, I'm from New York. You know, I enjoy both. I enjoy the deep thin slice, but I've got to vote for New York. I know a lot of the Second City boys out there will say Chicago pizza is better. I think they're both great. There's even a and there's New York pizza called a Sicilian pizza, which is a real deep dish pizza too. So, but anyway, quit fanning the flames. Anyway,
wait a second, Paul. I do have to say one thing. Now, you've never said this to me, but I have friends that live in Cleveland that are originally from New York. Okay, and the one thing that pisses me off about New Yorkers sometimes, not you though, yes, is Joel, New York is the best pizza in the world. The Cleveland pizza really sucks and it's terrible. So I always tell them, why did you move here then? Go back to New York, man. If everything in New York is the best, why are you here? Well, it's a little expensive to live there and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really makes New York pizza better than in other areas of the country, and I'm talking about even people that had pizza places in New York and had great pizza there and moved to other areas, and it's missing, and the same thing is true with a lot of bagel restaurants, is the water.
Yeah.
Because New York has that fluoride water and stuff like that. A matter of fact, there's a place that opened up here in the Woodlands that is a sister location to a pizza location that's right under the Brooklyn Bridge on the Brooklyn side of the East River. And it's Grimaldi's, and they bring the water in specifically for their pizza from New York. And I was there the other night, and I'll tell you one thing. It was exceptional. In my upcoming trip to New York, I hope to go to the Grimaldi's up there and compare. But in getting back to my original thought,
yes,
was that on this show they said there are over 3,000 pizza places in the New York City area. Now, with that in mind, why would you open up a pizza franchise in New York City?
I can tell you why. Would you like to know?
Well, first, I'm preempted by saying
it
because I have a lot of relatives in New York, and they always tell me, oh, yeah, Domino's open and they close. The Pizza Hut open and close. The Little Caesars open and close. And Patsy's and Joey's and Dominic's are all thriving. All right, now you tell me why.
Paul, I get a phone call once a month. There would be 12 prospective pizza franchisors a year call me, and they say, I'm thinking about franchising my pizza business. Okay, yeah, I know, yeah, yeah, why? Okay, why is yours the best? Well, it's because of the sauce. Everybody in the world who makes pizza, who has their own pizza shop, franchise or not, says their sauce is the best, and I don't get it. I mean, I don't get it. How would, in general, nothing against franchising, but how would a franchise compete with a Patsy's Pizza in New York City? I don't get it.
Anyhow, I think if somebody asked me about getting involved in pizza, I would say, if you feel you have that good a product, open up a small independent pizza place, maybe have two or three. We have one of those in the Houston market. It's called Brothers Pizza. They're from Brooklyn, New York. They have four locations. They've been in Houston for 30 years. It's as close to New York pizza as you're going to get. They got some great sandwiches and appetizers and stuff that go along with it. But they're not interested in franchising because they don't want to lose the quality as well as that feel, which a lot of people like that feel. And it's right next door to a Pizza Hut, and they actually have here distinctly different consumer base, and they both survive. But if you're looking for that good old-fashioned feel, people go into Brothers Pizza. If they're feeding the kids and they're having, you know, a sleepover with a bunch of rugrats, they go ahead and order Pizza Hut. That's just the way it is. So my suggestion is, you know, I know Sam Broberg up in Minneapolis that I tweet back and forth with. He had a great pizza concept, and he was doing good there. He had some problems with the retail space that he was in with the shopping center. But, you know, when I talked to him, I said, hey, you've got the recipes, you got the reputation, continue, move forward, but keep it on a local level. That's just my suggestion there, and I think it's the same with, you know, gourmet hamburgers or South Carolina barbecue or Memphis-type barbecue. Keep it local and keep it independently owned.
Yeah, that's a tough business. I mean, it's also a very high profit margin, but
franchising. I'm not trying to talk franchising here. I just think there are certain things that can be franchised. I mean, it's just like, you know, the neighborhood mechanic that's been there for 50 years. You go there because of him. If you start franchising that, it's not the same. It's just a name and a process. I think, you know, it's just that, you know, family-owned businesses are one thing and franchises are another, and there's room for both of them.
You're right. Speaking of room, I want to hear from your side of the desk, because we do a couple different things in franchising. You and I differ on a couple things. What franchise concepts do you like that are out there right now? Just based on personal choice, you know, if you're working with them, disclose it. If you're not working with them, disclose it. Who do you like? What do you think is a nice up-and-coming or a nice industry standard?
Well, first of all, I think because of the economy and the credit crunch, I think home-based businesses and B2B-type businesses, maybe where you just need a small office, is a good segment for franchising. Anything specific? You know, I'm not really sure. I don't have a favorite per se. I mean, if I had, you know, if money wasn't an object and I was to buy a franchise, I would do everything I possibly could to buy a McDonald's franchise, even if they told me to put it in some remote location. I think they're strong enough and have enough wherewithal that it probably is going to be successful. That being said, I don't have a fan favorite. I really don't.
Really?
I really don't. I there's not one particular that I would say absolutely buy it. You know, I think the reason is because there's so many copycats. You know, I think when Massage Envy started out, although I think it's a high cost for that type of thing, but I thought they were the only ones great. And that's not to say anything against Massage Heights or anybody else that's come out. It's just they've saturated the market, and now they're diluting it. They're diluting their chance of success. I think the same thing happened, you know, Snap Fitness. Great concept. You know, you buy a membership. You have your own card. You can go in there 24 hours a day. Most of the day it's not manned, so you're there, you know, alone.
Yeah.
And they have the security aspects in place. But now you have Anytime Fitness, and you have 10 different concepts that are like that. And it's actually causing confusion. I understand that's the American way, and it's free enterprise, and replication is a great form of flattery. But because of that, I would be hesitant investing my money in one of those, because I would be worried if another one opened across the street and another one went down the block. Probably one of my favorite segments of franchise is probably childcare. When you look at some of the big ones like Kitty Academy and stuff like that, when you look at the hours, 6 o'clock to 6:30, 5 days a week, no nights, no weekends. When you look at the, you know, residual income coming in because it's done on a monthly basis, and a lot of times people sign a 10 or a 12 month contract. That's nice not having to get new business every single week. I know in the automotive business, you know, every week put my key in the door for one location, I knew for that week my break even was, you know, $8,000, and it was from a new base every single week. So those type of things, and I think as we get into more two-income families and people are going to use child care a little bit more, I think that's going to rise to the top. I think anything in the senior care segment of the industry is a good opportunity to look at, but again, I would be careful of oversaturation there as well.
Yeah, I agree with you on the senior care. We've talked about it before. I mean, not that I have time, but I would guess that there are probably, between medical and non-medical senior care franchisors, there's probably 25 of them now, at least 20 of them.
Well,
and,
there's a bunch.
You know, you don't need that many. Don't need that many. And they're gonna have to fight it out to see who comes up with the best. I helped someone get into Brightstar Healthcare out of Chicago.
Right.
And I like them, not only because I got paid for making a placement, but I like them because they are choosy. They're very choosy about who they will allow to be a franchisee. There's a couple little things they do that I'm not willing to disclose, but they're very, very positive, and they're kind of what is the word I'm looking for? The requirements that the franchisees must do, but they don't know that they're going to be doing it. Put it like that. It's part of the qualification process. And
well, you know,
it's cool. Either you're the right kind of person for that business or you're not. And Shelly, the president, does some pretty cool things to find out. That's all I'll tell you. But it's pretty cool how they do it.
Well, you know, I agree with you there because, you know, a while back we had John Carlston of Process Peak. Which is kind of a customer relation, a CRM program for franchisors in franchise sales and development efforts. And I know Brightstar is using that and very effectively and very successfully. And I think it's because it is a process, which leads me to, you know, something that kind of irked me this past week. You know, Joe Matthews had an article or a discussion post on LinkedIn about franchise sales, franchise development, or franchise recruitment, which is the best process or what should be the process. And, of course, we all know it should be franchise recruitment because it should be putting the right franchisee in place, not just checkbook franchising to make it happen. But as I responded on one of his discussions, I forget which group it was because it was posted across several groups, but I only responded once, and it was, you know, I definitely agree, vehemently agree that it should be franchise recruitment, but that still depends on the founder of the company, the upper management of the company, and the trickle-down effect of philosophy. Because what normally happens is, and as we talked about at the beginning of the show about, you know, franchise sales and stuff like that and franchisors being behind the eight ball because franchise sales hasn't been what they have in the past. It's all so typical for the founder or upper manager to come out of his office and say to the franchise salespeople, sell something. Sell something.
Right.
Work the leads. Well, all of a sudden now you've gone from a recruitment process to a sales process, and you know what's going to happen. They're going to look for the path of least resistance, and they're going to go ahead and sell a franchise to somebody that shouldn't own a franchise, somebody that's not qualified for a franchise, and someone that just happens to have the franchise fee. I mean, I can't believe how many franchise, I don't know where you classify them. I guess they are franchisees because they've signed the franchise agreement and have coughed up the franchise fee, that are sitting out there right now and can't get financing for the concept. And I know a particular coffee chain right now that has 20 or 30 franchisees that have coughed up the franchise fee that for the last year and a half have been sitting idly trying to get financing to build their concept.
Unreal.
That's a problem.
Yeah, sure is. Financing in general is a problem, but it's been talked about enough in the past month, but it's tough.
But I do agree with Joe Matthews that it should be a franchise recruitment process, but that should be more of a conversation for the founders and upper management than it is for the franchise sales professionals that are out there in the trenches, because quite frankly, they've got to do and achieve the results that the founder and upper management puts on their plate.
Yeah, that would be true. That would be true. Unreal.
Sorry,
what else
you know,
like?
I know you. Yeah, you know, as we talked about, you know, you have a book that's great for prospective franchisees. You know,
right.
I happen to know of another publication that is a great read for prospective franchisees. You know what that is?
No, why don't you tell me?
It's the FDD. It's the
franchise
disclosure document. You know, as I wrote about, you know, using the franchise disclosure document as a guide, I mean, I would ask very specific questions and follow that FDD item by item and ask questions pertaining to each section. I mean, basically, if a franchise candidate was diligent in doing that, it's an almost missed roadmap, or almost can't miss roadmap, and it's going to put the franchisor on notice that you're doing your homework and they need to answer the questions. And I think what will be very surprising, because I challenge franchisors, and I'm not saying upper managers or founders, although they may fall into that category. Franchise sales professionals, how well do you know your FDD? And if I was a franchise candidate and I went item by item, I would want to make sure they pretty much were able to repeat to me exactly what was in that item that I just asked about in the FDD, and then I would ask them to explain it in further detail. And if they couldn't do so, not that that would be the only qualifying thing that we would want to go through, but if they couldn't at least do that, I don't need to be talking to them.
Yep. You're right. You're right. They need to know it big time. Big time.
How many do you think know what's in their FDD?
How many franchise sales reps?
Yeah.
Probably
60%. Yeah, I'm not talking about the royalty payment. I'm not talking
about
you know, other things. If I said to a franchise salesperson for XYZ franchise company, tell me the terms of, tell me what goes on once my franchise agreement, if and when my franchise agreement is terminated. Tell me exactly what happens when I want to sell my franchise and transfer it, and it being in accordance and running right along lines with what's in the FDD. I guarantee you the majority in our industry would not be able to tell us that.
Yeah, I would say that about 60% would be my guess. Know the thing really, really well, back of their hand.
I don't know, Joe. I'm going to disagree with you on this one. I think 60% is way too high. I think it's far less than that.
You do.
I do. I really. And be honest with you, too, that there's a lot of franchisees that don't have a clue what's in their franchise agreement because they never read it before they signed it.
I would say that probably more franchise candidates have missed stuff in their FDD because, first of all, they haven't read it. Second of all, they didn't use a franchise attorney. Than folks that didn't talk to franchisees before they bought. I would say because it's a hard document to go through. You have to be patient. You have to have a highlighter and a pen and, all that stuff, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there was another discussion on there, and I think you had answered it, or maybe you didn't. I'm not sure. It was
maybe
about Investing in a franchise, was it better to invest in a startup franchise as a franchisee or one that was established?
That wasn't me.
It wasn't you. Okay, well, it's out one of the LinkedIn groups, and I found it interesting because it seemed like the writer, the poster of the discussion, was leaning towards investing in a startup and justifying that, oh, I could get it cheaper, I could have a bigger share of the market, et cetera. But yet, when I was discussing it with somebody yesterday, I said, you know, all the things that we say minimize risk by being in a franchise, a proven system, some brand awareness, you know, all those things are out the window in a startup franchise. Not to say that a startup franchise isn't a good way to go. I think you need to be a little bit more entrepreneurial to be involved in a startup franchise and understand that you'll probably, as I've been preaching a lot of lately, you know, get off your ass and make it happen and make sure you've got a tremendous line of communications with the franchisor. But I think more importantly, realize that you're going to go through a lot of changes because, quite frankly, the franchisor is going to be learning right along with you, and they're going to be tweaking their operations manual and methods and processes because certain things are going to work and some things don't. And if the concept was built off of a company-owned store, it might not operate quite the same for a franchise location. And a case in point is an automotive franchise that I was involved with. We had a company store right next to the corporate office. And it did phenomenal revenue, Joel, and a phenomenal P&L and bottom line. But you know what? When they were too busy, instead of only being able to handle the work that they had staff for, we had a manufacturing plant. We either loaned them one or two people out of there, or they brought transmissions over to that department, and we rebuilt them. So they were able to do a little bit more work than a franchisee would have been able to do. Plus, if the manager didn't show up, we took one of our operations managers and plugged them into place. Or if the manager went on vacation, we were able to do that. We had our corporate staff handling the accounting and negotiating for better prices on parts and supplies. So, I mean, these are a lot of things that franchisees don't have the advantage of. So I would say to people, be cautious with a new startup franchise because there are certain things they have an advantage of that you might not have had in starting your business. Now, that being said, if you're entrepreneurial, I think a startup franchise could be a good opportunity and an opportunity where you could have larger market share or be able to develop or negotiate for an area development agreement on far better terms for you. But again, you got to work hand in hand and weigh the risks. And if you're somebody that's totally adverse to risks, I'd probably look at a more established franchise system where you can get involved with the camaraderie of franchisees and a system that's probably more tried and true.
Before you became a franchisee, did you look at yourself and ask that entrepreneurial question of whether or not you can follow a system or whether or not you would be the idea guy, or did you just go for it?
Yeah, I went for it because it was opportunity that presented itself. But if I go back to when my father-in-law first got in franchising, and I was along with him and the manager of his location, and we didn't know, you know, shit from shinola, I questioned it a lot of times. Is this the system? Is this a proven system? Is it reliant upon one person and that person doesn't show up and you virtually have no business for the day? I asked that question a lot and probably would have went in a different direction. But unfortunately, we were already committed. We were already into it. and we heard a lot of good things, but when it came down to it, it definitely was not the right business for us.
Really?
Yeah, definitely wasn't the right business for us at all. And, you know, and if I knew then what I know now, probably would have went in a different direction or developed an independent concept on our own or got into a different type of franchise. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, goals and objectives. And I think you have to really seriously look at, a franchise candidate should look at, you know, what are their wishes, hopes, and dreams? What are their goals and objectives? And define the type of business on paper that you would want, as opposed to looking at an industry segment and saying, oh, I always wanted to own a sandwich shop. No, if your wishes, hopes, and dreams are, you know, I want to be able to take time off. I want the family to be involved in the business. I don't want to work weekends. I don't want to work nights. Whatever you jot down on paper, come down to a common denominator and then look for a franchise that fits your wishes, hopes, and dreams, because that means it'll meet your expectations and you won't be surprised by, you know, oh, well, I didn't realize I was going to be stuck here 90 hours a week and I've got no time for nothing. Or I'm so reliant upon one key person that I feel like I'm working for that person. So I think it really takes a good old-fashioned pen and paper of finding out what they want out of a business before choosing which business to get involved in.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's got to be what am I good at, and what do I want my life to look like a few years from now? What do I want my day in the life to be? And what kind of business do I think I would be a good fit with? Those are all really important.
Yeah, I mean, you know, mechanics are not good automotive franchisees. A chef is, you know, a culinary trained chef is not a good food service franchisee. They're too entrepreneurial. They want to do things their own way. And then, of course, it opens up the door to a whole bunch of questions, which you and I have discussed off the air regarding partnerships and family involvement and support from family. There's a whole bunch of questions that you really need to ask out there, and you bring up a good point. What do you want your life to look at like 2 years from now, 4 years from now, 5 years from now? And then adding to that is the what-if questions. You know, what if our business is strapped for cash? Who's going to put it in? You know, what if one of us gets sick? Who's going to go ahead and pick up the pieces? And how is that person going to be compensated? What if, you know, we need to bring one more person in the business and it's a family member? Does the other one have the opportunity to bring in a family member as well? There's a lot of questions. And the thing that I really promote in talking with any type of person that has that entrepreneurial itch is that as you're putting together your business plan, make sure that a very essential, vital part of your business plan is in place. And that's the exit strategy. And that exit strategy needs to be a voluntary one and an involuntary one. And it needs to be clearly defined of knowing how you're going to get out of it before you even get into it. And, you know, a lot of banks are taking that same philosophy now. They're really looking favorably at business plans that has an exit strategy and a what-if strategy. What if the business can't support this, you know, debt service? What's going to happen? And if that's clearly in place in the business plan, banks and lenders are going to look at it a little bit more objectively and possibly maybe not less cautiously, but maybe more diligently, because they'll understand that it has been completely thought out.
That's right. You are on the money, as usual. So what's going on for next week? Are we doing anything?
No, we're off for Turkey Day, and we'll resume 2 weeks from today. And we've got some exciting things on the show planned for then. And we are running out of time right now. Joel, why don't you take us to the house and tell everybody goodbye?
Hey, everybody, have a great Turkey Day. Next week, we're going to be off the air, but eating turkey. And just remember, go slow when looking at franchises, and you'll be okay.
Well, everybody, have a great day. Have a great Thanksgiving. I'm Paul Segreto with the ever-loving Joe Labava, the Franchise King, saying goodbye, and as always, be safe.
See ya.